Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Alex and Alexander, what an absolute pleasure to welcome two gentlemen to the show that certainly been seeing quite a lot of you guys, since all this, what do we call it, Ukraine conflict. How are you both doing?
Oh, very well. very well, and obviously very pleased to be here on your show.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's probably long overdue, fellas, to be honest. Should we just start? Do you want to just give a bit of background about yourselves? How did you meet, and how did you decide to start a podcast?
Well, we met in Moscow. Actually, we were there for different reasons, but on business trips for different reasons, and we ended up being at the same location, and that was the first time we met. But it took a few months, if not a year plus, before we actually decided to work together. And the media side of things, the podcasts and the video, was just a way for us to reach a wider audience, because you know we were both working in more of the writing of articles, say the blog posting sphere of things, as we were covering stories. And you know, we decided to give video a chance. And when we started to do our videos and posting them on YouTube at the time, like 2000, I believe it was like 2019, 2020, we saw that it worked, and we've been doing it ever since.
Yeah. And when you say you came together, what were your backgrounds in?
Well, we are both obviously Greeks. We are from two different states within Greece. I'm from Greece, from Athens. Alex is from Cyprus. But we both have, in some ways, some similarities in background. Alex comes from a diplomatic family. I come from a political family, well-known political family in Greece. Therefore, we are both in completely different ways, if you like, not exactly insiders, but people who know a little about how politics and diplomacy work. And we had this meeting in Moscow. We talked about many things. We found that we agreed with each other on many things, and we had different perspectives which seemed to complement each other, and it all came together. But that's essentially our background.
And Greece, wonderful place. I drove across it once on my way to India. Remember, I was with about 15 other guys, and we slept one night up at the Acropolis, I think it was, on the sort of the rocky outcrop. We just took sleeping bags up there, and in the morning we had this wonderful view of the Acropolis, and also lots of snakes that had come out of the rocks to sunbathe and were all around our sleeping bags, which that was a memorable moment. I always remember frappe coffee as well. Absolutely delicious. Yes,
you're a true Greek, Chris.
Yes,
frappe. That's when you know you're local.
Well, I saw something there for the first time that we, as I'm sure you guys know, we don't really do in England, and that's where if you order a coffee in a cafe or a restaurant, they give you a glass of water with it. I guess because it's so hot and the coffee's dehydrating. Never seen that before.
I think that's kind of like you'll order, like, just say a filter coffee or an Americano, but and they'll always give you a glass of water. But I think that's kind of like a hangover, a legacy of when they would give you the Greek coffee, because the Greek coffee is very heavy and you have to have water with the Greek coffee. And I just think it's carried over now to all coffees. But Yeah, they'll always give you a glass of water with whatever coffee, even a cold coffee. If you order just, an iced coffee or whatever, they'll always give you a glass of water.
Alexander, can you just explain for our friends out there, the Duran, where did that name come from?
Well, this is a mystery to me. I mean, because of course Alex set up the Duran, or at least the structure that became the Duran before I joined. So I've often asked him where the name came from, and he has kept it a mystery from everyone, including myself. But what I will say is this: it does have obviously an origin in Latin. It has an in within Latin a sense of strength, of durability, duration. That's where it comes from. It gives that sense of strength and firmness.
Got you. Alexandra, I meant to say, can you see yourself on video or?
No.
Okay. All right. If so, I would have got you to record your side of things and we could have paired them up, but not a problem. So yes, how has it been then? Because you've been obviously very vocal on the whole Ukraine Russia thing. You've got hundreds of thousands of followers out there now. Have you taken a lot of flak for your you've tried to sort of do, what do we say? Honest coverage. And honest doesn't always go down well, does it, when people are taking sides in things?
I'm going to give my own view about this. I think we've had surprisingly little flack. I mean, we get some people who contact us or who say unpleasant things about us. But actually, I think the way we approach this whole topic, which is a very analytical one, we take it apart, we discuss it. I think it keeps people away. I think that they don't want to take us on, or at least a lot of people don't want to take us on, because we try to be objective. We try to look at the thing altogether in the round. And the result is that we're perhaps not the most simple target for people to attack. So overall, I'd say that we've had less trouble than I might have expected, given that obviously we're taking a different perspective from other people.
Alex, you got anything to add on that?
No, I agree. We have taken flak, and people have come after us. I think whenever you're going to report on the truth in any a conflict or in any news story, obviously you're going to get a tremendous amount of pushback. But we take an approach where we, just try to report the reality of the situation. When we started the podcast, our approach is always a real politic approach. We try, though we provide a lot of emotion, and we provide a lot of laughs, and we try to provide some humor as we have our discussions, or as we each do our individual shows. We try not to let the emotion interfere with the reality of the news. So even though we'll joke around about things and we'll laugh about things, it doesn't change the reality of what the situation is on the ground, or what's unfolding in this instance in the conflict in Ukraine. It's not about emotions or how you feel, even though it's a very emotional topic, and it's a horrible topic to cover. I mean, it's not an enjoyable news topic to cover for a year and a half, but we have to report the reality of the situation. You have to. I mean, there's no way around it.
So, are you guys coming from like a humanitarian perspective then? I mean, I'm guessing you are. It's kind of crazy, isn't it, that people will sit there and on their ivory tower in the comfort of the West, or to use a cliche term, and they're actually wanting men, women, and children to be bombed in another country. It's almost like a psychopathic concept, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. We are horrified by the war. We are horrified by the disaster, the humanitarian disaster that is now taking place in Ukraine. And both of us see film and analyze pictures, which are not really the sort of pictures that most people perhaps would want to see. And we see a lot more of that than the vast majority of people do. And it is beyond horrible. It is absolutely shocking. But you use the word psychopathic, which to a great extent, I think, summarizes and describes the situation well. The other point we make is that psychopathic foreign policies, the kind of foreign policies that have resulted in this disaster, are in nobody's interests and certainly not in the interests of the Western powers. The point about this war is that there were many opportunities going all the way up to the events of March, April last year to find a way out, to end the war, to resolve the conflict. Those policies, had they been followed, those decisions, had they been made, would have left us in the West in a much better position politically, diplomatically, and internationally than the one in which we are today. And through an extraordinary, complex range of reasons, but ones which focus very much on overambitious plans, psychopathic plans, if you like, to use your phrase, that some people have, those options, those alternatives for peace were not taken. And so we have a disaster in Ukraine, a humanitarian disaster in Ukraine, and we have a disaster in international relations.
Yes. Do we think that, what do we think the whole agenda is there going on? Because it's very easy to, I don't know, look at it from a three-dimensional perspective. Putin bad, Zelensky puppet. But then when you factor in things like the Belt and Road Initiative, it all just reeks that there's something else going on that I think most people are not a party to.
The thing to say about this, and I'll try and be brief, is that, of course, the people who've been driving these policies have actually made no secret of what they have intended right from the start. If, again, you follow, you read the kind of publications that these people write within the Washington system, they have various publications, the National Interest, Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic, the website of the Atlantic Council. They've never really made any secret of what they want to do. They want to split the Russian-Chinese partnership, alliance, arrangement, call it whatever you will. They've decided Russia is the weaker party. They've gone after Russia. President, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has said quite openly that they aim to weaken Russia through this war. And the idea is that you cause a debacle for Russia in Ukraine. That will in turn trigger a political crisis in Moscow. And the idea again is that once that crisis has played itself out, you will either have a compliant government in Moscow that will change its policy and side with the policies of the United States, which is, and the West, which is what Mr. Wes Mitchell, a former State Department official, said would happen. In other words, align against China, or that Russia would become so weakened that it would no longer be useful to Russia, to China anymore as a strategic partner, and that the danger of the strategic partnership, the Chinese-Russian strategic partnership, would be shattered. And that is something, as I said, that's been discussed extensively, and it is why we are where we are now.
Do we think we're going to see Ukraine join NATO then? Because there's been a recent conference, is there not, where Zelensky rocked up dressed in his Action Man gear. He looked like his mum had dressed him up for a fancy dress competition or something. But it also seems like NATO kind of don't really want them to join.
No, they're not going to join NATO. And NATO, I think, made the message very clear that they're not going to join NATO. I mean, going back to what Alexander said earlier with why are we in this conflict? This has nothing to really do with Ukraine. This entire conflict is all about getting at Russia, and Ukraine is just being used as the vehicle to weaken or split apart or balkanize, whatever you want to call it, regime change, Russia. That's it. And Putin, in a statement many months ago, he said that Ukraine is just being used, and he used the term battering ram. It is being used as a battering ram towards Russia. And he's right. That's the entire conflict that we see unfolding is about Russia, not about Ukraine. For Russia, it's about Ukraine, because it's for many reasons: geography, national security, culture, language, the east of Ukraine, Donbass, the Maidan coup. There are many reasons that Russia is invested and interested and sees Ukraine as critical. But for the West, it's about trying to find a way to weaken Russia, to balkanize Russia. So NATO, may have been an option for, at least Ukraine may have thought that this was their ticket into NATO by fighting the Russians. Now we're going to prove our worth to NATO. But you see, the NATO powers never saw it like that. They're not looking for Ukraine to enter NATO. They're not looking for Ukraine to enter the European Union. They don't want Ukraine to enter the European Union. For them, Ukraine is just useful at this moment.
Yes, I've got you. And what's going to be the end to this conflict then? Because if you look at Bakhmut, it's absolutely flattened. It looks a bit like Hiroshima after the bomb went off. And you see these stories, and I'm probably like you guys. I mean, I do a bit of research on Telegram, and some of the videos are just horrific. I mean, we're talking like there's bodies everywhere, and it's... I mean, Ukraine surely don't have, when it comes to manpower, don't have many resources left, or do you have a different perspective on that?
They are running down their resources, and you mentioned Bakhmut, and of course these similar pictures appear in other cities. I mean, there's another town called Marinka, which I saw pictures of, and Bakhmut looks in a good condition compared to Marinka. I mean, Marinka, it isn't just that every building has been damaged. Every building has been leveled. I mean, there are no buildings which are more than a few meters above the ground. I mean, it has been shattering to see what is happening. But of course, Ukraine is running out of men. It's now been admitted today in the New York Times that they're having to replace younger men with older men, and that the older men are less easy to control than the younger men are. That's already a horrifying thing to say, an appalling thing to say. But they're running out of weapons. They're running out of shells. The United States has had to send them cluster munitions because it can't send them unitary shells. And Ukraine's own stock of unitary shells is depleting. Ukraine has run out of an air force. Its air force isn't functioning. It's running out of air defense missiles. It's running out of tanks. It's running out of everything. But it is still attacking. It is engaged in an offensive. Why is it engaging in an offensive when it is losing so many men and machines and weapons? It is conducting that offensive for the reason that Alex said, because that is Ukraine's purpose at the moment. It is to try to weaken Russia. So Ukraine, despite losing so much of itself on the battlefronts, is obliged by its sponsors to continue attacking. And that's what is having to do. And it deepens the tragedy. This is unsustainable. It cannot continue indefinitely. People who talk about a stalemate in Ukraine are not being realistic. There can be no stalemate in Ukraine whilst the war continues in this way, because the reality is, instead of Russia being weakened, Ukraine is being destroyed, and eventually the Russians will be left with the situation where there is no one left on the battlefield to fight them.
Why haven't Russia then, why have they not sort of pushed their advance outside of Donbass and is it up across the Dnipro? You would have think with their, I think it's Colonel McGregor talks a lot about this, that their superior weaponry and manpower, it's like they almost haven't touched it yet. You know, this is just the, you know, we've just sort of seen their extras go in, even using Wagner as opposed to, you know, the real troops. Why are they holding off when you think that they could probably ride into Kiev today?
Well, we didn't say that they could ride into Kiev today. I mean, that is the point, because, of course, there's still a large Ukrainian army. There's still lots of equipment. From a Russian point of view, fighting this war as an attrition war has many advantages. It limits their own losses. It enables them to build up their forces. The Russians always wage war in a way that uses time to their advantage, and that is what they do. They're taking fewer losses, despite what you read in the West. They're taking far fewer losses than Ukraine is. So they're allowing Ukraine to deplete its army. They're allowing Ukraine to deplete its arsenal of weapons. They're causing the West to deplete its arsenal of weapons too. Remember, the United States has now admitted it has run out of 155-millimeter shells. The West European states have admitted that they're now running out of tanks to send to Ukraine. So from a Russian point of view, waging this war in this way has many advantages. And simply launching an advance to Kiev, bringing the war over quickly, ending the war in that kind of way, would present the Russians with a host of other problems of perhaps a future insurgency, controlling a country that is still partly armed, which I don't think they want to do. And in terms of opinion in Russia, it would perhaps result in heavier casualties than the Russian government wants to accept.
Yeah, so I guess at the moment it's almost as if they're defending the Donbass. Whereas if they move further west, they're really going to look like the bad guys. Is that kind of about it?
Well, to some extent, as I said, I think increasingly Russian opinion has hardened to the point. I'm talking about public opinion, not just governmental opinion, has hardened to the view that moving west, taking Kiev, is perhaps the only way that this conflict can be resolved finally. That was not the general feeling in Russia at the start of the conflict. And of course, the Russians also need to consider what international opinion would think about this, not just opinion in the West, which is, of course, completely hostile to what the Russians are doing, but also opinion in the wider world, in countries like China, India, Brazil, Turkey, Iran, where governments might not have been very happy if the Russians had simply marched into Kiev and established a new government there, given that Russia has gained a lot of support around the world by appearing to oppose regime change. So prolonging the war has made it easier for the Russians to say, we're not really fighting Ukraine. We are fighting the West. Our aim was not to occupy Ukraine. It was to parry the West. and the way the war is being fought has basically helped the Russians make that argument.
And just another point on what Alexander is saying is that this war, this conflict towards Russia was essentially won during the first 3 months, because that's when the West launched their economic war against Russia, the shock and awe sanctions that they threw at Russia, which was, you know, 10, 15,000 different sanctions packages when you put them all together, targeted towards Russia, an unprecedented amount of sanctions targeted towards Russia with the sole purpose of sinking the Russian economy and eventually leading to a collapse and a regime change of the Putin government. The minute that Russia withstood and prevailed over those sanctions was the very moment that they won this conflict. And they're not in a rush now because they don't have the economic weight on their shoulders. They don't have an economic crisis that they have to deal with. Actually, the economy is booming. It's moving towards growth now, which is the exact opposite of what's happening in the West. And Russia has moved away from the Western architecture and the Western financial system. So the minute they were able to withstand the economic war that was thrown at them is, I believe, the moment where they could take a step back and say, okay, now we've bought ourselves a lot of time. Many, many years we've bought ourselves to look ahead and to plan this conflict out, not the conflict with Ukraine, but the conflict with much of the West. And diplomatically, they won over the partners of China, the partnership of China, India, BRICS, the Global South. So, you know, they're sitting pretty. They really don't have much of a reason to rush this.
Yeah, and they seem to survive the pipeline thing with I can't think of the expression, but the sabotage pipeline didn't seem to affect them as much as perhaps it. I mean, that just seemed like a big propaganda exercise at the expense of what?
Germany.
Ah, right. Yes. Yes, Germany was still getting their gas from Russia, weren't they? And they were hesitant to relinquish their supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was the fear was that Germany was going to walk back much of the sanctions, because as winter was approaching in the September timeframe, as winter was approaching, Germany started to realize that things were not going well in this conflict. The sanctions packages were not really working. The German economy was suffering. It was deindustrializing, a term that we discussed on many videos. And the fear in Washington was that Germany would start to walk back much of the sanctions that the United States was pushing Europe to put on Russia. So they figured at least it's my thought, and many analysts, including Seymour Hersh, many journalists believe that the Biden White House, they said, you know, there's only one way we can completely cut off all the bridges for German rapprochement with Russia, and that's to be done with this Nord Stream pipeline once and for all.
And yeah,
that appears to be what happened. Appears to be.
So, just to get some closure on this, friends, what do we predict the ending of all this is going to be? How's this going to move on? I mean, we saw Afghanistan was just like the Yanks just up and left, like literally, and left. Billions, well, I'm probably exaggerating, but I'm going to say billions of dollars of equipment there, which completely defeated the reasons that they entered the country in the first place, which for people out there who are too young to remember was to defeat the terror camps that Afghanistan had. And they've now left those exact alleged camps with the best equipment in the world. So how do we think Russia and Ukraine, what's going to be the resolution here?
There is now clearly a push developing amongst at least some people in Washington and to some extent in Europe, to start to try and find some kind of way towards negotiations. So we are going to probably see some attempts to try later, at the end of this year, once this Ukrainian offensive has played out, some mechanism to start talking to the Russians. We've had the CIA director, William Burns, who is a former US ambassador to Moscow. He's a diplomat. He's established contacts with the head of Russian intelligence. They've been speaking with each other. We've had various ex-diplomats meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. The fundamental problem with negotiations is that whilst it was certainly possible to see an agreement worked out last year, which would have protected everybody's core interests, Ukraine's, Russia's, those of that of the West, and we came extremely close to that point where that happened. Many people don't realize that in March, April of last year, the Ukrainians and the Russians came very close to an agreement. They'd sorted it out in principle. Each side had initialed it. It was our governments, the British government and the US government, that torpedoed it, that sabotaged it. We've had outside witnesses, the Prime Minister of Israel, the Foreign Minister of Turkey, confirming that that was what happened. The problem is we can't now realistically return to that position because too much has happened. The Russians feel themselves much more confident than they were that at that time last year. As Alex was saying, they have actually overcome the problem of the sanctions. In fact, their economy is now growing so strongly that the central bank is worried that it might be overheating. So it's had to push up interest rates to try to calm to slow the level of growth, which is completely the opposite of what everybody had expected this time last year. So the Russians feel themselves strong. They've also obviously experienced losses. They've seen what people in the West think of them. And in any negotiation that now takes place, they will make demands. And there's been a long article in the Russian government newspaper by Medvedev, who is Putin's number two, in effect. They're going to make demands, and he confirmed that, which are going to be very, very difficult for the West to accept. They're not going to just want a resolution of the crisis in Ukraine. They're going to want a fundamental change to the security architecture in Europe. And this is the problem. We could walk away. I say we, the United States, the Western powers, could walk away from Afghanistan because Afghanistan is far away. It's in Central Asia. It is not a seminally important country. Ukraine is different. It is on the border. It is part of Europe. It is a war that has been fought in Europe. NATO has been involved. The Western powers have been involved. If Ukraine is militarily defeated, it will be a total debacle for the West. And if the Russians impose terms, it will be a debacle for the West. And the Russians know that too. And they're going to leverage that fact in negotiations to demand concessions beyond anything that we have seen before, and it might be very, very difficult for the Western powers, especially the United States, to agree to.
Let's move on, chaps, to everyone's favorite topic. Not mine, I really couldn't care less, but Trump and Biden. It is almost like the political version of a circus. And I'm just picturing Joe Biden driving out in his clown car and it blows up in a load of smoke and the wheels fall off. And that was before he became president. So what do we think there? Is is President Trump the big orange savior that he's heralded to be, or is the fact that he, let's just say, went along with a certain narrative of the last 3 years? I think everyone knows that the narrative we're referring to, we won't say the words, that he moved the, was it, they moved the American consulate from, was it Tel Aviv into Jerusalem? You know, is it, was he bailed out? Was it by the Rothschilds in the 90s? Is, I'm just saying that a lot of people pin a lot of hope on this guy. I just wonder if it's, you know, excuse my French, folks, but same shit, different day.
Look, my two cents on Biden Trump is you got Biden who's being protected at all costs, and you have Trump, and they're targeting Trump. They obviously don't want Trump to be president. Now, if Trump is president, does he change things? Does he drain the swamp? Does he build the wall? Does he do all of these things that he's promised? You know, he had one go at it, and it didn't work out. He did none of those things, really. I won't say none. He didn't accomplish the lofty goals that he had set out to accomplish. And he filled his cabinet with a lot of nasty people, a lot of warmongers, neocons, people that ended up stabbing him in the back. I mean, it was not exactly a good look. The two schools of thought, as far as Trump is concerned, is you have people who say, well, this time around, he's going to get it done because now he has experience. Now he knows how the deep state works. Now he knows how the government works. He knows who he can trust and who he can't trust. So now he's going to really get it done if he's president. Now he's going to really drain the swamp. He's going to really make America great again. He's going to make all this change. So that's the one school of thought. The other school of thought is he had one chance at it. It didn't work out. He's going to get another shot. Just expect the same, and why give him that shot? So, you know, but when you look at Trump compared to all the other candidates, it's who else do you really have on the Republican side to go with? Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, you know, I mean, even DeSantis, he's really, the hype around DeSantis has completely evaporated.
Yes. You're asking someone who's never voted. I just encourage everyone else to do the same. Yes. What Biden's obviously got ties to Ukraine, that he doesn't seem to have to face the music over everything, and nor does his son, which kind of backs up what you're saying, Alex. This whole laptop thing, it's putting all the sickness and perversion aside, are we really seeing this in front of our eyes, or is this kind of like, is this some weird dream and we're all going to wake up from it and go, oh, right.
No, unfortunately, it's not a dream. It's the truth, and it's the very troubling truth. Now, once upon a time, had a laptop like the one which appeared in the middle of an election, then of course, over the course of that election, it would have become the subject of political debate, and it would have almost certainly destroyed the candidacy of the president, of the person who was involved in that laptop through his son, and who was seeking to become president. I think it is inconceivable that in any other time period in the United States, Biden could have survived the damage, the potential damage. What actually happened was that the FBI had possession of that laptop for months, I think maybe more than a year, than its eventual appearance. I mean, it had been going backwards and forwards. They'd seen it, they'd examined it, they knew what was in it. They said nothing about it. We had a whole group of intelligence officers come forward and say that this bore all the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. We had the media close ranks and basically suppress all discussion of the story. And on social media, which we all operate on, well, we had an awful lot of pressure at the time not to discuss the issue. So there was a sort of closing of, you know, a suppression of every sort of avenue of discussion for this. And this has continued ever since. We have this happening to a greater and greater extent. What Alex said, protecting Biden, even as Donald Trump is the target of all kinds of legal claims, some of which I have to say, I find myself difficult to understand. I don't even understand the legal theories behind them. So that in itself, it seems to me, is the most serious issue about this election. Put aside the candidates, put aside what Trump might do or what Biden might do. The fact that there is such a powerful force, an unaccountable force, that is in effect shaping the entire American political discussion, keeping information away from the people of the United States so that they can look at it, they can look at the laptop, make a decision, look, see what is going on. That is the single most troubling and worrying thing about this election and this political contest. So Trump versus Biden, to my mind, is in some ways the least important thing. It's the theater we all see. What is really happening is that we see what it's difficult to avoid calling an oligarchy, a deep state, if you like, essentially tightening its control of the political process in America. And that is something that should worry us all.
Is Trump not going to face that again when he, you know, during his next campaign for presidency?
The Daily Telegraph a short time ago wrote an article saying that if by any chance Trump is elected, he will face from the deep state in the United States, and actually the title of that article referenced deep state, that he will face an attack far greater than the one that he faced in 2016, 2017. So that is a very worrying fact, and it is the most worrying fact. My own personal view is that Donald Trump was essentially ineffective as a president, at least in foreign policy terms, largely in his first term, because he was constantly having to contend against all of this. And if we have an even more epic battle coming in the event of his re-election, it's going to be very difficult for the United States to conduct any kind of foreign policy at all. And it is a dangerous situation because the United States remains a pivotally important country. And it does need a president who is able to make decisions and to take decisions like, for example, seek negotiations with the Russians in order to disengage over Ukraine, or perhaps seek talks with the Chinese about finding some kind of way to end the really dangerous conflict that's now developing over Taiwan. So this is a very bleak picture. And it means that the political battle, as it used to happen, isn't happening anymore and can never properly play out, which in the kind of society that the United States is and that the Western countries are, it is the worst possible outcome that you can have.
And I guess one thing that can be said under Trump's presidency is, unlike his predecessor, he wasn't like the king of the drone strike, was he? But he did. Was it Soleimani that was taken out? He was. They call him an Iranian warlord, don't they? And he was on his way to Baghdad. There's some confusion there. I've heard a few different narratives, but I mean, it's just it is it not insane that, I mean, Obama got the Peace Prize? Did he not? Did he not get the Nobel Peace Prize? And yet, did he not also launch more drone strikes than any other president? Sorry, folks, I'm not laughing at the horror of it. I'm laughing at the just the utter incredulity of the state of play, basically. How do we get to this? The Peace Prize goes to the person that's killed more people than any other. Yes, Alex, any thoughts?
You're right. It's, you know, Obama did get the Peace Prize. Actually, I think he got the Peace Prize before he even started his term. That's how excited they were for the Obama presidency. But his term ended up being a disaster. And yeah, he launched a terrible amount of drones and missile strikes. And you have Syria and Libya and all kinds of chaos at the hands of the Obama presidency. And Trump, Soleimani, yeah, that was that did happen as Trump was president. There's a lot of different viewpoints as to what exactly happened with Soleimani, who was, in my opinion, illegally assassinated. From what I understand, he was actually functioning as a representative of the government, and there was a lot of talk that he was actually working on some sort of peace agreement, and that's why the neocon faction of the deep state, the war machine of the deep state, decided to take him out in order to prevent any type of peace within the region. That's what some analysts speculate happened. And you can even take it further, where there are many many analysts who believe that Trump didn't actually give the go-ahead for this action. It was actually the Department of State under Mike Pompeo, as well as some Pentagon officials and John Bolton and these types of characters that actually pushed the assassination to happen. And Trump was brought in to everything that happened afterwards. And then they staged this whole to walk everything back and to calm down tensions. They staged this whole Iranian missile strike on a U.S. airbase. The Americans were told when it was going to happen. Yes. They were told to remove any assets. The Iranians didn't lose face. And that's how the escalation was walked back. But it plays to the fact that Trump was surrounded by terrible people. He allowed himself to be surrounded by terrible people. He hired these people. He put them into positions of power. To me, that is the most worrying part of Trump's presidency, his past presidency, was the people that he surrounded himself with.
Mm. Yes, I call them the big club. They're in positions of power everywhere. The UK is no different, you know. Yes. Folks, can we just touch on a few cheesier things, can we say? I just want to get your thoughts, because obviously you've got a media platform, so you come across this stuff all the time, as do I. The whole Epstein thing, and I'm just going to say pizza without going into any details. What is this? Is this all distraction, or is it this all just symptomatic of a very sick, quote unquote, elite that, you know, got low moral fiber, and the power to live out whatever they want to do, or is it, like I say, is it just another distraction?
I don't think it is just another distraction. I think that there is something at the root of this. Anybody who has followed politics in both Western Europe and in the United States, I think, would accept that there has been a growth, a very steady growth of corruption in the West over the last decades. And of course, corruption can take many forms. It can take financial corruption, which is, in my opinion, in the United States at least, now out of control. It can also take other forms of corruption. And again, one has to be careful in one's choice of words, but sexual corruption, undoubtedly, is taking place also. And the reason that is happening is that we've seen two developments over the last decades. Firstly, we now have a class of what you might call professional politicians. The political class has become professionalized. That they function within politics, no longer as, if you like, connected to larger social movements that throw them up as leaders in a political battle that plays out and in which is decided in elections. Rather, they're a kind of class of people who are always there. They all know each other. They're all very come from similar backgrounds. They dress in the same way. They hold essentially same opinions, and they're represented in all parties. And to a great extent, they protect each other, and that has conferred an element of impunity, a sense that you can do things which once upon a time it would not have been possible to do and to get away with. And we've had a perfect example of this because Biden is absolutely a member of this class, as are his family. And we've discussed the question of the laptops. We've seen how he was protected. It's an extreme example of the way this class now protects itself and is protected. And of course, against this background, all kinds of, you know, horrible things are developing and are thriving. So it's symptomatic of this growth of corruption within our political systems. And of course, corruption, after a certain point, if you've experienced it, it becomes the organizing principle around which political systems are based. If you're not corrupt yourself, you fall under suspicion from those around you who are. And within a corrupt system, it's the pursuit of the gains that corruption can provide, which ultimately become the main focus of politics.
Yes, got you. Alex, any thoughts on that? Anything to add?
I mean, Alexander's exactly right. I think it's definitely been a progression. It's been an evolution to take us to where we are. A terrible evolution, but it's been evolving to take us to this point. And it's very real. I think it's very real. And a lot of people try to pretend it's not real. But with each passing day and week, we see the cracks are forming and a lot more people are starting to see that what's happening in society is really happening, and they're taking notice. This can't be hidden for much longer, even though there are powerful forces that are trying to hide it.
I want to come back to the solution on this, but before we do, and my last point for you, good gentlemen, and thank you so much for spending so much of your time on the podcast. Central banking, digital currency, digital passports. I'm just going to chuck something into the mix here. I was out with a friend the other day in a place called Bournemouth, and seaside town for our friends out there that don't know it. And I went to a chain pub. By chain pub, I mean these big clubs, rather, that crop up everywhere. I think this one was Walkabout. It's an Australian-themed pub. We get a lot of our brothers and sisters from Australia hitchhiking around the UK and coming over and staying for a year. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful people. But there's me. Joined the queue for this club. It was a short queue. It was about five people. And when I got to the door, the guy said, right, scan your app. I said, I'm sorry. He said, you got to scan your app. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, well, you got to download the app to your phone. It's your digital identity. And then you scan it into this. They actually had like a Big Brother TV screen, a computer screen screwed to the wall of the club, if I remember rightly. And I'm like, can you explain it? And at this point, the guy said, so I took my camera out. I thought, you know, if you're going to do this stuff, you got to be accountable. So I said, no disrespect, my friend, but to protect you and me, I'm just going to film this conversation. At which point, he started to threaten me with physical violence, which kind of, I always think, tells you something. And I said, listen, I'm not trying to get violent. I've done your job, you know, several times over. I'm simply asking you, is this the way forward? One of his colleagues came up and we went and had a chat, and I said, you know, what's the point of it? Oh, it's so we can get data on people. We can find out who they are, if they've got a criminal record, perhaps they've got problems with alcohol, da-da-da-da-da-da. And from what I understood, a lot of that input was by the clubs, i.e. not by, you know, an official or someone qualified to make decisions on someone's mental health or their, you know, capacity to drink alcohol or what. It was like, if you get marked as a wrong'un, all the clubs are going to go, right, you ain't coming in here, mate. And I said to the guy, I said, you know this is wrong, don't you? And he just basically said, yeah, but what can you do? You know, exactly the same response we saw throughout the whole COVID thing. Yeah, but, you know, you got to get on and you got to just, it's like, well, no, you literally don't. You literally don't. So, yes, central banking, digital currency, digital passports. What are we thinking here, guys?
You want me to go? Look, my opinion on CBDCs is they're going to come to every country. Every country is going to try to implement central bank digital currencies. I think that's a given. It doesn't matter if it's China, Russia, or the United States, UK. They're all going to give a go at it. You know, it's up to the people. It's up to the people and the shop owners and the businesses whether they adopt these digital currencies. They control everything. It's going to be that app on your phone that's going to control everything about you. It's going to control where you go, how you spend your money, the time limit placed on money. So you'll get your paycheck and you'll have maybe 3 months to exhaust that paycheck. Otherwise, it will disappear. It will be deleted. There's all kinds of implications. It'll be connected to your electric vehicle. And, you know, perhaps your carbon emissions or your carbon footprint will be connected to all of these things as well. And it's all just going to be one unified system. And it may dictate how many times you can travel a year, what distances you can drive, things like this. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the people. If the people adopt it and they use it and the shops adopt it and they mandate that you use this currency to pay for things, then, you know, the pessimistic viewpoint is that it's going to gain traction. It's going to gain adoption and it's going to be used against us eventually, against the people. If the people don't adopt it, then it's, as with any technology, it's dead. You know, any website you build or social network you build or tech you build, if it doesn't get adoption, it shuts down. So that's where we are with this.
I think we can see from the example I gave, when there were literally people angry with me in the queue behind, all they wanted to do was scan their thing and go into the club. You know, they were youngsters. They had no clue that, you know, as to this conversation.
I believe it will be adopted. I mean, my personal view on things, I believe not every country, but I think most countries, especially in the West, I believe in the West, it will be adopted. In Europe, in the UK, in the United States, Canada, Australia, it will be adopted, and it will be adopted enthusiastically. I believe in other countries where they're more cynical and more skeptical. For example, I believe Russia, they're much more skeptical. I think they're going to say, no, we don't want this thing. And I think a lot of countries are going to also be like that. Maybe a lot of countries, I believe, in Latin America. Once again, countries that are skeptical about their government, skeptical about control and power, and just have a culture of built on more, you know, so there's more skeptical about big government in general, and they like to focus more on the family unit and small communities. They're going to reject these types of things. But I think in the West, this is going to be adopted without much pushback at all. I hope I'm wrong, though.
I'd love it if there were countries that push back, but again, using the last 3 years as an example, even remote islands in Polynesia that never seen a Westerner before were wandering around wearing certain things on their face and, you know, injecting toxins into their kids. Friends at home, the reason we're having this conversation is we could get to a point. I mean, here's just an example where the three of us, just for having this conversation, when we go to pay for our groceries next week at the supermarket, it comes up with a nah at the till. Sorry, Mr. Thrall, last week were you having a conversation where in which you badmouthed the president? Sorry, we're taking away your credit for 1 week. And it's not as though that's far-fetched, because I got kicked out of places the last 3 years.
Could I just bring up a point of a story that we covered, that was covered in the UK extensively, and we covered it on the Duran the other day, which is Nigel Farage. And I think this is actually a positive development in that, you know, I said that most Western countries will adopt it, but you see, they went after Farage. They tried to debank him. At first, many people didn't really pay much attention, but eventually the story gained traction, and now there is pushback. So maybe, you know, maybe there is hope. Maybe even if it's adopted, eventually they'll overstep and they'll take it too far, as they always do, and they'll go after someone like a Farage, and they'll tell him, you can't buy groceries here at Tesco because you were friends with Novak Djokovic. And Farage is going to say, okay, well, if that's how you want to go about it, let's go. And, you know, he can get a lot of people to push back. He's an influential voice. So maybe there is hope. There is hope. There's always hope.
Can I just say, I think that is exactly what will happen if this is adopted in the West, and it will be. I mean, the governments are pushing this. And Alex talked about Russia. I mean, people in Russia might be more cynical about this, but we should be under no illusions. The government there also wants to have digital currencies. Putin just had chaired a meeting about the introducing a digital ruble. But if this happens, and if it is used in that way that you've just described, which it will be, because why wouldn't governments and authorities use it in that way if they can? That is their nature. Then what will inevitably happen over time is that people will understand that if they actually use digital currency, they're being monitored. They won't want to be monitored. And we will slowly see, and perhaps not even that slowly, perhaps rapidly see, alternative payment systems functioning in an informal way starting to develop. So you'll start to see people who will accept payments in other things, not digital currencies, but other tokens, mechanisms, whatever. In other words, what the authorities will like to call a black market, which is always the expression that's used to denounce this sort of thing, they will eventually, because remember, initially, it won't be illegal. It will function in a legal way, because if you want to, say, go into a club, you don't want to use digital currencies because you don't want people to know about you, or you have problems at Tesco, you can develop other systems, barter systems, all that kind of thing. The governments won't like that. They will try to criminalize it in some way. Difficult to see how it can be done, but in terms of legal theory, but no doubt that is what they will try to do. And we will get into a spiral where something is being enforced by the governments, resisted by the populations, and eventually that will result in radicalization. Now, I'm not saying this out of nothing. If you have knowledge of economic and social history, you know that this is exactly the cycle that is always followed. And within 5-10 years after its introduction, this whole structure will start to crumble because people will resist it, because they will feel that they have no choice.
Gentlemen, just to finish on a positive, because it's all been quite negative. Oh, excuse me. I believe in solutions. And I'm just going to put my cards on the table. For me, the biggest thing in my life has been the spiritual battle. It's just revolutionized the way that I wake up, the way that I act, the way that I think, the exercise I do, the diet that I eat, the meditation that I do. There's so many issues in the world, whether it's Biden, Trump, Syria, Ukraine, CBCDs, and I'm well aware I have very limited influence in trying to change the whole world, who essentially follow the materialistic, capitalistic model, which is in, programmed into you in school, etc., etc. So that's what I do. I believe the battle is within. It's a bit like Bob Marley said, what was it he sang? Have no fear for atomic energy because none of them can stop the time. Mm-hmm. So I believe our thought form processes is where it starts. It starts with ourselves, and that energy that we then give out is putting something positive, let's just say, in into the universe. It's a bit like when people get confused about this. I say it's really simple. You know, when I eat vegetables and I run around the block in the morning, I have my sauna, I got a plunge pool in the garden, I spend 10 minutes outside the sauna, I just meditate and I focus on one utterly incredible experience this life is. It's just brilliant, and I'm so grateful. Despite everything that we've discussed, I'm so grateful that I meet beautiful people. I've got beautiful people around me. I've had a great life in 85 countries. And when I then go out to do my shopping in Tesco, or you know, I say hello to people and I'm happy. And that person that I've just said hello to, and nobody does this in the UK. Now you walk down the street, people just like look down at their phone. They are physically like ashamed to say hello to people. We've all been so damaged by this program. And here's the thing. I do say that hello, and I'm well aware that that person I've just said hello to, I might have just made their day. Because my energy is high, my frequency is high, and they might have just been, and this is an extreme example, but in the veterans community, it's not extreme. So I'm a former Marine. We lose a lot of people every year. I'm going to say, you know, it's to isolation. It's to feeling unloved, unwanted, unworthy, ill-fitting, da-da-da-da-da-da. So I've just said hello to someone. They may have been on their way home to, you know, take their own life. And that's how I think the, you know, the way out of this is. We need to get, well, I say we don't need to do anything. I would love it if we could get rid of this system in schools where it's all about, you know, grades and competition and teach love and teach people to love each other, and that it doesn't matter what you do, what your skills are, you're born perfect. doesn't matter if you feel like a girl or if you feel like a boy, who cares? You don't have to start like chopping stuff off your body or taking chemicals. You are massively loved, and it's fine to be individual, and it's fine to be different. And I think love is the highest form of vibration, and it trumps all of this silly, like, let's bomb someone else's country that we've never even been to that country. We don't know the people there. And I always say this to my fellow service personalities, like, guys, if we walked into a bar, right, and there's a Ukrainian sat there and there's a Russian sat there, what would happen? I tell you what would happen. Within 10 minutes, we'd all be sharing a beer, right? Cheers, swapping email addresses, and we'd be friends for life. So that's my positive, folks, to add to the pot is the spiritual battle. Fellas, do we have any thoughts on that?
Well, can I just say, I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head, if I can put it like that. It's about humanity. It's about establishing human connections and human relationships. I mean, people sitting around in a bar, sharing a beer, swapping email addresses, people being polite and friendly with each other, all of these things are the kind of behavior which you expect human beings to have towards each other. What we are talking about, all of the things we're talking about, the psychopathic foreign policy that you discussed at the beginning, the increasing corruption, the levels of impunity, the attempts to control people's behavior through these digital mechanisms. What that all amounts to ultimately is a process of dehumanization. In other words, there is an attempt to push us towards not being humans. But the point is, we are humans. So ultimately, we will resist these pressures that are being imposed on us, because we can do no other, because that is what we are. So I actually think you're right, and I think it is a message of hope. And ultimately, it's exactly, if you go back to my previous answer, people will establish their own networks. They will find ways of interconnecting and doing things with each other, good things with each other. And they'll always find ways around these complicated digital systems that people are trying to create, because that is the human spirit, human nature, if you prefer. And ultimately, it always wins through.
Great words, Alexander. Thank you. Alex, do you want to close?
I have nothing to add to both you and Alexander's statements. I agree. In the end, we should be hopeful. And we should not worry so much about what's happening in the world. Terrible things are happening all around us. This is the way of the world. It always has been the way of the world. And we should look within ourselves and understand that when all is said and done, things will work out in the end.
Alex and Alexander from the Duran folks. All the links for these guys' socials and channel will be below this video. Please go and give them your support. Just, I'm absolutely honored that you've joined me today. Thank you so much. And to all our friends out there, if you can subscribe, consider supporting our Patreon, in which case you get free tickets for our upcoming Bushcraft weekend. That just leaves me to say massive, massive love to you all. Go study. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.